Good morning, everybody. Thank you all for coming along to this Comparative SEPTED conference. It's the fourth SEPTED conference or event that we've run in the last 2 years, so it's fantastic to see a good turnout, particularly this close to Australia Day and this close to people returning from leave. My name's Garner Clancy. I'm a lecturer here at the Sydney Institute of Criminology, and it's with great pleasure I welcome you to this event. Before we begin the proceedings, I would like to acknowledge and pay respect to the traditional owners of the land on which we meet, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. It's upon their ancestral lands that the University of Sydney is built. As we share our own knowledge, teaching, learning and research practices within this university, may we also pay respect to the knowledge embedded forever within Aboriginal custodianship of country. A couple of quick things from me, and then we'll hand over to the first speakers, Dr. Rachel Armitage and Dr. Paul Cousins. Some housekeeping. We're serving our morning tea, lunch and afternoon tea in the Law Lounge, which is just up the stairs. I expect we'll lose about 50% of you because it seems to be the way in this building, but we'll be around to direct you. Just up the stairs and to the right is the Law Lounge. The toilets are across the hall. The breakout rooms for the sessions, the parallel sessions, are just along this hallway on this level, 022020. And if you've got one of your programs, you'll see where the breakout sessions are. Again, we'll be around to help you, but it's just along the corridor to the right. It should be relatively easily found. Fire exits up the stairs, and you'll see glass doors at either end, so just up the stairs and to one of the fire exits if that is required. We will be in this room for the bulk of today, so if you found your way here, then hopefully you'll keep finding your way back for the main sessions. As you know, this is the fourth event in a series of SEPTED events that we've organised. This is taking a comparative focus. The reason for the comparative focus is we're really interested in trying to learn from other disciplines, other regions, other jurisdictions. So today I think we've gathered quite an amazing group of speakers from various jurisdictions to talk about their work, their research work, their practice, their applied work. And our hope is that through that sharing of information and knowledge, it will spark some ideas, shape your thoughts about your own work, but equally that you'll be challenging some of the speakers to consider some of the things that you've experienced in your own jurisdictions or own workplaces. I'm delighted that people have come far and wide to be here today to present to us, and I do want to make particular mention of Rachel Armitage and Leanne Montunk from the Huddersfield University, and Paul Cousins from Western Australia, Chris Butler and Sue Ramsey from New Zealand, flown some distances. A couple of other speakers from interstate, Tony Lake from Queensland, Tony Zalewski from Victoria, James Brinkett from Victoria, Jennifer when she gets here from Adelaide. I think the benefit of having so many different views presented today will hopefully ensure that it is an excellent event. I'm also excited by the fact that we have criminologists, urban designers, landscape architects, council staff, planners, people from the late night economy, a whole host of different disciplines being represented today, which again demonstrates the breadth of our thinking around SEPTED and hopefully will ensure that everyone gets something from the day. At the outset, I want to thank all of the speakers. I know how much work goes into preparing your presentations. I met with a number of them yesterday and saw that there was some fine-tuning going on, demonstrating how much energy they've invested and how concerned they are to make sure that their presentations are as good as they can possibly be. I will thank you again at the end of the day, but it's a massive effort, so thank you very much. The only other person I want to thank at this point is Jonathan Knapp from SJB. SJB are an architect firm, designers and planners, and they've sponsored our evening drinks, probably the most important part of the day. So I'll thank Jonathan again a bit later on, and you can acknowledge his support when you see him with a beer in your hand. Now, before I invite Rachel to present to us this morning, if you haven't collected a list of bios, I encourage you to before the next session. We produce these so we don't have to spend 10 minutes before each presenter elaborating on their illustrious careers. So read the bios and get a sense of their work, and that will save us from lengthy introductions. What I will do is hand over to Rachel and thank her very much for flying all this way and being so Not at this time of year. I imagine it's a great desire to flee the north of England. Thank you very much, Rachel. Please, thanks, Rachel.
Okay, good morning, everyone, and welcome to this conference. And thank you very much to Ghana and colleagues for inviting me and my colleague Leanne Munchuk to the conference today. As Ghana said, this is me, Rachel Armitage. I'm a reader in criminology at the University of Huddersfield, and I work within a research centre called the Applied Criminology Centre. So in today's presentation, I want to review the evidence on what works in designing out crime from residential housing. I want to highlight some of the practical issues that have been raised within the UK. I want to bring together the evidence base to present to you today and offer some guidance to you on how to avoid some of the problems that we've come across. Although the review of evidence that I'm presenting is international, the specific case studies that I'm going to be talking about are UK-based. However, I believe that many of the problems and solutions that I'm going to be discussing are transferable to Australia and New Zealand and the places that you guys have come from. So I want to start with a very quick overview of crime prevention through environmental design in the UK over the last 15 years. So we've had a huge progress within this field since 1998 in the UK. There's been an increase in recognition that design can impact upon crime and that crime reduction is not the sole responsibility of the police. This has been reflected in academic research and increased funding for academic research in this field, in policy, including planning policy and crime reduction policy, and in the practical application of this on the ground. There's been an accepted recognition that design can influence crime. However, little attention has been paid over those 15 years to which specific features of design influence crime. This has led to some conflicting policies in the UK, and we may have policies that agree that crime is an important consideration, but differ on how they think that this crime reduction should be achieved. And this has led to some confusion amongst practitioners on the ground. So as a means of addressing this, the Home Office within the UK have recently funded a major project entitled Residential Design and Crime. The aim was to strengthen and update the evidence base on the impact of residential design on crime, to try and clarify some of the confusion that there's been within the UK, and to focus on developments that they were telling us were good practice or award-winning developments and estates. They wanted to know whether or not good design in terms of architecture is also achieving crime reduction. And it's from this study that I'm going to be presenting some of the findings of today. So a very brief overview of the methodology of the project. I can't go into too much detail because of time restrictions, and you could come and grab me at the end if you want to talk about it. But there were three strands to the project. The first strand was a detailed literature review, in which we scoped the evidence, and we were looking at research, policy, and guidance from across the world. So we were looking at the US, Australia, Europe, but we were only focusing on articles that were written in English. In terms of the analysis of crime, the first strand was the macro level, and this included 34 developments, and by development we mean a housing estate, which may include between 50 and up to sort of 300 houses. And within this sample we had 4,900 houses or properties, and this was spread across three police forces in the UK. So this was a larger sample, which allowed us to conduct a less detailed analysis, but we had a larger number of properties. So in this, we were comparing the crimes experienced at these developments with our government's previous assessment of these properties in what they call a housing audit. So we were able to look at more properties, but we were relying on assessments that had been conducted by the government, not by ourselves. In the micro-level analysis, which is the one I'm going to be focusing upon today, we were looking at 12 developments, so 12 housing estates. There were 2,193 properties in this, and again, it was spread over three police forces. So we had a smaller sample, but we were able to conduct a very detailed analysis on this sample. We were comparing crimes experienced at these houses against the individually assessed environmental features of every single property, those 2,193 properties, and every development. And these features were the features that we chose to assess, and we actually conducted these assessments. So looking in a bit more detail at this micro or case study strand, I just want to get across to you the detail of this part of the project. So as I said, we had 2,193 properties, and for every one of these, for every development, the research team conducted the following strands. So They conducted interviews on site at each of these developments with some key personnel. And these key people, firstly, were what we call our police architectural liaison officer within the UK. And this is a person within the police who is responsible for looking at the SIPTED features of every planning application that comes in. We were also interviewing our local authority planning officer, so this is the person who makes decisions about whether or not a development can go ahead, and someone from what we call the neighbourhood policing team. So this is the police who are responsible for that specific geographical area. We discussed the questions, the interview questions, and we raised the issues whilst we were on site, and this allowed us to put some of the comments that they were making within the context of the development. We also completed what we called a design features checklist. And this was collecting data relating to 31 specific design features of every single property and 19 design features of every single development across that 2,193 houses. We also completed what we called a design quality checklist. And this was data relating to the design quality, the architecture of every property and development. So I can't give you all the questions on the design features checklist. This is just a screenshot of the first page. But if anybody wants to get a copy of it, then feel free to grab me after the presentation. So as I said, we were asking these 31 questions about the house and 19 about the development. And questions we were basically asking were things like, are there footpaths within this development? Where do those footpaths lead to? What's the lighting at these footpaths? How wide are they, etc.? The design quality checklist, again, this is just a screenshot. There were 20 questions, and these were completed by our urban designer, who was answering questions such as, does the housing have a character of its own, which is suited to and enriches its surroundings? So these were related to the design quality of these houses. So conducting the interviews, as you can probably tell, this was a unique and painstaking methodology which produced some really detailed results. One element that I want to just go into a little bit of detail about in terms of methodology, which worked really well, were these interviews that we actually conducted on site. So we were interviewing these key people as we were walking around the development. We could see the issues in context. We could challenge these people if we noticed problems that they hadn't raised. And the agencies were able to talk to each other about their agendas and any problems that they had. So as you can see, these photos show the interviews taking place at the development. This is a photo of my lovely colleague here, which she'll be absolutely mortified. Another element which worked really well was the actual physical completion of these checklists. So two researchers, were physically completing these checklists for every single property. And I can say this worked well because I didn't actually do any of this at all. The privilege of being a reader meant that I could send Leanne out in all weather to basically complete all these questions for all these properties. It was very time consuming, but we feel that we were able to assess the actual layout on the ground and the use of the development, as opposed to making remote predictions, which some methodologies do, using GIS, for example. I just want to point out, actually, Leanne is wearing lots and lots of waterproofs there because it was snowing and windy in England, and she kind of looks a lot different here in real life. She's mortified. So there were loads and loads of findings from this project, but I'm just going to focus on two particular key themes that emerged. I'm going to look at the impact of car parking on residential crime and the impact of connectivity or through movement, which is sometimes referred to as permeability within the literature. So car parking. We found within the project that the design and layout of car parking provision within residential housing can have a significant impact on crime and antisocial behaviour at that development. And this was a very surprising finding, that we were finding that this car parking was a consistent priority or concern raised by these key personnel at all the sites. We didn't expect to be coming away from the research feeling that car parking was one of the major issues to impact on crime. So we found that poorly designed car parking wasn't just linked to vehicle crimes, such as theft of and from the vehicle, or criminal damage. We found that the provision of car parking was also leading to problems such as youths causing annoyance or youths hanging around, neighbour disputes, and also it was leading to some violent crimes. So what does the previous research say on the impact of car parking on crime? Well, we found just two studies which actually discussed the impact of car parking provision on residential crime or burglary. Brown and Altman in 1983, they looked at features of burgled against non-burgled properties and found that properties without a garage were more likely to be experiencing a burglary. Cromwell found the same, and they basically used staged activity analysis, which is taking offenders on drive around the area and asking them what makes a property vulnerable to crime. And again, they found that properties which didn't have a garage were more vulnerable to burglary. So what did we find? Well, in the macro section of the analysis, and this is where we were relying on the government's housing assessors to answer the questions, they were asking the question, to what extent is the car parking within this development situated as not to detract from the street scene? It's a kind of strange word question, and we didn't come up with this, but we've kind of got to work with it. So a score of 1 suggests that the parking within this development did detract from the street scene. So this would suggest that you had cars parked in front of the properties and on the road. A score of 3 suggests that the parking did not detract from the street scene. And we found that as compared to a base score of 1, developments which scored 2 were experiencing 40% less vehicle crime and 68% less criminal damage. Developments which scored 3 were experiencing 74% less criminal damage than those that were scoring 1. But there was no statistically significant difference between those scoring 2 and 3 for vehicle crime. So the conclusion here was that cars that are parked away from the street scene, so they're not on the main street in front of the house. Now, we can't tell whether or not this is within a garage or a car park because we didn't ask this question or do the analysis. They were experiencing lower crime. In terms of the micro-analysis, so this is the bit where we could ask the questions, we found that properties which had communal parking, so in a communal area, were experiencing higher levels of vehicle crime than those with on-plot parking, so parking which is within the curtilage of the property. And we found that developments which had allocated visitor parking were experiencing lower crime than those which did not provide allocated visitor parking. So I want to go through some of the practical issues relating to car parking that we found. And this is from the case study part of the project. So the first one was something that we call rear parking courts. I don't know whether or not this is something that you would have in Australia. But this is an option for parking the cars away from the property frontages. It's aimed to make sure that the street scene doesn't appear dominated by cars. And by its very nature, this is, provides parking away from view of the properties and away from the view of the street users. It's often accessed by an archway which runs between the dwellings, so if it is property, you can see that there'd be dwellings on either side, and there would probably be a dwelling above. These archways are often very narrow and dark, with very little surveillance from the houses around. There are options to gate these entrances, but these rely on people, residents and visitors, actually using those gateways. So this is another photograph of a rear parking court. As you can see, the walls are often very high, and as you can see, there are very little cars parked within them. So the implications of car parking in these rear parking courts, what we found. We found that many residents, even where there was no alternative for parking, would not park the cars in these rear parking courts, which was their allocated vehicle parking space. The reasons were that they feared for their own safety when they were in these parking courts and walking back from the parking courts. They were concerned about the safety of their vehicle, and they didn't want to carry a convenience issue. They didn't want to carry their bags or their children or their work from this parking court to where their house was. And where these were unused, and which was the case with most of these rear parking courts, they were being used for antisocial behaviour. So youths were hanging around in them, sometimes stealing cars and what we call joyriding, so riding the car around the car park and abandoning the car. And the more they were used for this illegal activity, the less likely that people wanted to park in them and use them for the reason that they were there. And the cycle continued. So the next problem that we came across is where the developer or the architect, again, it's the same issue. We're trying to solve the issue of cars dominating the street scene. And this was leading to some unintended consequences. So as you can see from this picture, the architects and developers had purposefully designed the driveway, if you can see where the cars are parked, so that it was too short for a car, so a car didn't actually fit on the driveway. And the idea was that they felt that this would make people park either in their garage, which, if you can see the black on that photo, was the garage, or in the rear parking court, which, if you can see at the end of the photo, is the archway. However, as you can tell from this photograph, the residents continue to use the driveway. That's where they wanted to park for convenience and safety. Thus, cars were left jutting out onto the street. And this was a really common feature. I can only put a couple of photos up, but you can see again on this one. These are very small cars. If you can imagine if these were larger cars or vans or 4x4 vehicles, they would be parking basically on the street, blocking the path for pram users, wheelchair users, etc. So the implications of this were residents continued to use the driveway. That's where they wanted to park the car, for safety reasons, for convenience reasons. And as I said, as a consequence, these cars were jutting out. The design solution that these architects and developers have made three incorrect assumptions about the way people use the development. They presume that residents are happy to park their car out of sight, which we found that they weren't. That residents don't mind walking a distance from where they park to the property, and that residents will use their garage as a parking space. And I don't know about in Australia, but in the UK, people very rarely use the garage to actually park the car in. They tend to use it for storage of paint or bikes or whatever, I'm not sure. And so at these developments, they had to employ management companies at great cost to the residents living there to enforce parking regulations to stop people parking in this way. So the next problem we found, and this is highlighted from the photograph, was again a lack of consideration for the end user in the provision of parking. So here we have two properties. So the bay window here and the bay window here, two separate properties. This parking space is the parking space for just one of those properties. So as you can tell, somebody is looking out all the time from their front living room window onto somebody else's car. That's just one parking space there. Now, if this is a small car, it may not cause too many problems. You can imagine if this was a works van parked there quite a lot, or a 4x4, you're looking out of your front window directly onto that car, and this may cause some issues in terms of neighbour disputes. The second photo is not quite as good, but it basically shows that the perspective is not very good, but those patio doors basically almost open out onto that parking space. And the implications of this were that we found that neighbours were leaving angry notes on the cars, basically saying, move your car out of the way, we don't want it parking here. And quite surprisingly, an analysis of the police crime statistics found two serious crimes that had actually escalated from neighbour disputes at that first property. So one was a public order offence and the other was an assault. So one person living at one of those properties had actually assaulted the other person based on the kind of built-up frustration at having to deal with the fact that they were looking out continuously onto someone else's car. So the key research findings relating to car parking. We found that these rear car parking courts were experiencing higher levels of crime and criminal damage and were facilitating access to the rear of the property. So it was another access route for offenders. We found that developments which had allocated visitor parking experienced less crime. We found that developments with communal parking were experiencing more crime than those with on-plot parking. Residents prefer to park close to their property, and where there is none provided, they will find their own solutions and perhaps park illegally in front of the property. We found that a lack of consideration for end users can result in expensive retrofit solutions, such as the employment of management companies. And disputes relating to car parking can actually lead to more serious violent crimes. So we move on now to connectivity. What was the impact of connectivity? Well, connectivity, or through movement or permeability, refers to the type of road serving a property or development. So is that property on what we call a through road, so you can drive all the way through? Is it on a cul-de-sac? Cul-de-sac is where you can drive in, but you can't drive out again without coming the way that you've driven in. And some of these terms I just want to explain in case you're not familiar with them. Is it a true cul-de-sac? So this is where you can drive in and drive out. and you can walk in, and if you're walking out of that cul-de-sac, you've got to walk back the way you came. So there's no connecting footpaths leading off that cul-de-sac to other areas. Is it a leaky cul-de-sac? And this is a term for a cul-de-sac which you can only drive in, but you can walk out of this cul-de-sac to different areas. Is it a linear cul-de-sac? And this is a cul-de-sac in which if you stand at the end, you can see right the way down to the end of that cul-de-sac. Or is it a sinuous cul-de-sac, in which case, when you stand at the end, you can't see right the way into the cul-de-sac, so it might have bends or it might be quite a long cul-de-sac. And this will become clear, these terms, when I start to discuss some of the previous research on this. It also looks at movement throughout the development. So are there footpaths leading throughout the development? Where do these footpaths go to? Are they at the front of the property, the rear of the property? How good is the lighting, etc.? So previous research in this field, some of you will be aware that there's been quite a lot of research on connectivity. A recent publication by someone called Hillier and Savaz argued that there are insufficient empirically based studies to form any conclusions regarding the impact of road layout on crime. Well, in our study, which came the year after this project, we found in our review of 71 research documents that this was not the case. We found many methodologically strong studies which were preventing clear findings relating to the impact of connectivity on crime. So just what is the problem with connectivity? What bothers people about this issue? Well, put simply, the connectivity debate centres on the following arguments. It argues that increased connectivity or through movement can lead to a positive result, so it can lead to less reliance on the motor vehicle. People are more likely to get out of the vehicle and walk or cycle to where they're going to. And this can have a positive impact, they suggest. By having more pedestrians on the street, you create more surveillance or more eyes on the street. Others argue that it can have a negative impact, so it can create increased access routes and escape routes for offenders. It can lead to increased anonymity for offenders, so they can say basically, I was just walking along that footpath trying to get to the shop, I wasn't trying to eye up your house as a target for burglary. And again, it can create an increased opportunity for offenders to become aware of a potential target. So they may walk along that footpath every day and notice that that house is vulnerable, they've got some expensive things in the window, etc. Our review of literature favoured the argument that increased connectivity leads to increased crime. But I'd like to just highlight two buts here. There was one particular methodology that we found, not ours, that other people were conducting, and I'm going to discuss that in a minute, that produced some very different findings to the ones that we found. And we did have, within our study, we did find that you can develop housing estates with high levels of connectivity if you do this with security in mind and if you consult with the police throughout the development. So this table presents the studies that we looked at which found that increased connectivity leads to increased crimes. And these studies were using a variety of different methodologies to come to this conclusion. So it's a lot for you to take in, and I don't expect you to kind of take it all in. But basically, I've kind of summarised research that says that being located on a development with high connectivity increases the risk of crime. Those that found that being located on a travel path or a footpath increases the risk of crime. Those that said that being located on a cul-de-sac reduces the risk of crime. And those that found that closing streets reduces crime. And I'm just going to pick out two of the studies that I've highlighted there which used particularly rigorous methodologies and just go through some of the things that they found. So Johnson and Bowers in 2010, these are from the Jill Dander Institute at University College London. They actually looked at over 180,000 homes in the UK. And this is, again, quite sometimes the wording is not quite clear, but they found that all things being equal, relative to a property on a local road, which they class as a road which connects neighbourhoods, a property on a major road, which they class as one that connects towns and cities, that major road will have an expected increase in burglary of 22% compared to the local road. For properties on private roads, which they don't use the term cul-de-sac in this part of the project, but it's one that has no connections. relative to local roads can expect a decrease in burglaries of 43%. They say that for a street segment, for each additional link to another road, the predicted burglary count will increase by 3%. So the more connections to other roads, the more you're likely to be burgled. Just summing it up, they found that cul-de-sacs are safer than through roads, and this is where the term sinuous linear comes from. They said that sinuous cul-de-sacs, if you remember, that's the one that you can't see all the way down, are safer than linear cul-de-sacs. And actually, this is something that we may raise in the debate later on, but some of the guidance in the UK, and I think I noticed in Victoria, in Melbourne as well, has said that that you should have linear cul-de-sac, that they are actually safer, but this is not what Johnson and Bowers found. So Armitage et al., this is our study. 6,000 properties we looked at in the UK, and we found that compared to a true cul-de-sac, one with no footpath connections, a property on a through road experienced 93% more crime. Compared to a true cul-de-sac again, a property on a leaky cul-de-sac, one that's got footpaths connecting it, will experience 110% more crime. As with Johnson and Bowers, we found that sinuous as opposed to linear cul-de-sacs were the safest. So in a review of the evidence, and this is 2002, but I think that this is quite an important quote, Taylor concludes that neighbourhood permeability, which is the same as neighbourhood connectivity, is one of the community-level design features which is most reliably linked to crime rates. The connections operate consistently in the same direction across studies. More permeability or more connectivity equals more crime. We find this assertion is not entirely correct. And there were several studies that we found, and these were studies which use a methodology called space syntax. I'm not sure if any of you were aware of that. And they conclude that increased connectivity has a beneficial impact upon crime. So this is contrary to what we and the majority of studies were finding. Now, space syntax is a mathematical approach which remotely, so they're not visiting the site, they're using computer modelling, remotely takes account of the street networks and how each street segment connects to other streets within the area. And if anybody can explain space syntax better than that, then please tell me, because I find it a very complicated methodology that's not always explained in the UK, not always explained particularly well. And this is a study, a summary of the studies that we found. This is just that we found, so I'm not saying that this is the hot, you know, anyone, if anyone else has found any others, then please tell me. That found that increased connectivity equals less crime. And just to stress it, these methodologies were all using space syntax. Historically, and rather unhelpfully, I don't know if this is the case in Australia, but in the UK, this has been presented as a very polarised debate. So cul-de-sacs are safer, cul-de-sacs are not safer. And this has actually been quite unhelpful, really. We found that this disparity is more likely to just relate basically to the methodological differences that these studies are using. Space syntax, as I said, is a computerised method which makes predictions about the layout and the movement rather than looking at the actual use. Where a development is physically assessed by the field workers, as we did, you can make clearer distinctions about the layout, about the official against the unofficial footpath, and you can observe the actual movement taking place on that development. And rather than focus on the difference, we felt that it's time to start focusing on what the consistent findings are and perhaps how you can compromise on this issue. And a consistent finding across all the studies using all the methodologies was that leaky cul-de-sacs with footpaths connecting, are the least safe place. A compromise that we found within our case study analysis showed that you can have developments with high levels of connectivity and low crime. Now, this particular development was in the West Midlands in England, which is, if any of you heard of it, an area called Birmingham. And this development was a very high crime area. It had a large number of footpaths, but experienced no burglaries within a three-year period. And this is extremely unusual for this area. It was a very high crime area. The developers, when developing this, had insisted that this development has high levels of connectivity, but they developed it in very close consultation with the police. And this scheme has something called the Secure by Design Award, which I won't go into detail in here, but I can talk to you about it if you want to. And all the footpaths within this development ran at the front of the properties. There were no rear footpaths, so no footpaths running around the rear of the property. They were all required, so there'd been a lot of thought going into where those footpaths were. So as a consequence, they were all very well used by people living in the area. That's just another photograph of the sort of connectivity within that development. So some of the issues in terms of connectivity, some of the problems that we highlighted. We found that a major risk to increasing crime is what we call rear footpaths, footpaths running at the rear of the property, where they have little or no surveillance from the properties that run at the side of them, where they're not direct, so such as this one, which has hiding places running through the development, people could sort of lurk around the corners, and where they have poor lighting. We also found that side footpaths, footpaths that run at the side of properties, also leave properties vulnerable to crime. Now, this photograph was a stairway footpath in one of our really high quality development. And our design expert actually thought, he went to this site and actually thought that this was an excellent feature of the architecture of this development. You kind of can't tell, but the stairs run down the development. It's quite an attractive kind of footpath. However, when we analysed the modus operandi of the burglaries on this estate, we found a huge number of burglaries were being committed at the two houses at the side of this footpath. The offenders were going down the footpath legitimately and hopping over the wall and accessing these properties through the rear of that footpath. So what appeared to be a good design feature, actually, when you looked in detail, was leading to quite a lot of crimes being committed. We found that corner plots, which bounded the footpaths, were particularly vulnerable to crime as well. This property was a corner property on which bounded this canal footpath. So it was a very attractive footpath, which ran along the canal in Manchester. And I'll just go back to the photograph. This was a very low crime development. There was hardly any crime in this development. But this property had felt the need, the photo doesn't show it very well, but it had installed CCTV cameras at their own choice, their own money. It had installed spikes on the top of that fence, if you can see, and they'd also put anti-climb paint all along this sort of fancy thing that they put up. I don't know what you'd call it, actually. So this was a very vulnerable property. Or they felt vulnerable. This was something that made them feel unsafe being located next to this footpath. We found that all those footpaths within developments do increase crime. You do have to be careful when you are closing footpaths or rerouting footpaths following the redevelopment of an area. Now, this is the rear garden of a new cul-de-sac which had been developed, and they had put the rear fence in the development, so it was all part of the development, and it had closed access from one cul-de-sac to a really busy walkway which led into the centre of town, which is behind that fence. And the field workers who were actually conducting the research, they actually witnessed people constantly climbing over this fence from the busy footpath. This is somebody's garden, the rear garden, cutting through the rear garden to get to the development which was next to it. So they saw people hopping over quite regularly, and the residents have put anti-climb paints on the top of this fence to stop people doing it, which wasn't working at all. Another problem, or another issue that we found, was gated developments. I don't know how popular gated developments are in Australia, but they're becoming a lot more popular. Yeah. Residents viewed this as being a safe option of somewhere to live, but our research didn't confirm this at all. We found that they were very unpopular with the planners who we talked to, and they were unsuccessful at minimising or reducing crime. The planners felt that the privacy that they had created could have been created using much more subtle techniques, such as a narrowing of the entrance to the estate, a change in the road colour, a change in the texture. And they expressed a view that they wouldn't repeat this exercise if they were developing these estates again. The problem, this is another photograph of a gated development from a different angle. The problem was that the boundary of these developments was gated, but once you got inside, there was very little consideration for crime prevention. So if you can see from this footpath, once you get inside these gates, You have high internal connectivity. You had lots of dark, narrow alleyways with little surveillance. And it was as if they kind of had a reliance on the gates and felt that these gates will stop people getting in so we don't have to think about anything else once we're inside this development. We also found that the security of the gates was compromised by really stupid, inconsiderate, poor positioning of street furniture, street signs, and things like utility boxes. So if you can see, this is a gate that's meant to stop people getting in, and someone's put the street sign right next to the gate. So same with a utility box. You've got this huge gate. Please don't come into our development and burgle us, but we're going to put a utility box there so you can climb over and get in if you want to do. An analysis of the crime data showed that the properties that were located very close to the gates were very vulnerable to crime. Okay. So road layout, the conclusions. Research supports the notion that being located on a development with high levels of connectivity increases the risk of crime. Two cul-de-sacs experience the lowest level of crime. Leaky cul-de-sacs experience the highest level of crime. Sinuous cul-de-sacs are safer than linear. Gated developments do not experience lower crime. Footpaths at the rear and side of property increase vulnerability. But footpaths can be included without increasing the risk if they're planned in close consultation with the police. And I'm concluding now. I didn't know I could talk for half an hour, actually. This is crazy. I must be really passionate about footpaths for a reason. So why does it matter? Why does it matter that there's different findings? Won't there always be different findings within research? This has become a problem, basically, because the conflicting findings are making it very difficult for practitioners on the ground to know what guidance to offer when they're making decisions. The UK has seen huge progress in convincing agencies that you must design in crime prevention, but much slower to confirm how you actually do this. What are the specific features? This has become a greater priority amongst a rapidly changing system within the UK within planning for crime prevention. Leanne's going to talk about planning in crime prevention at the moment, but we've got some really big changes happening at the moment within the UK that I just want to do 1 minute on before I conclude. We've got some huge cuts in police budgets in the UK, 20% cuts in budgets over the next 3 or 4 years. And the ALO post, which is our post within the UK, which looks after SIPTED, has been cut from 305 posts in 2009 to 230 posts at the moment. And this is only the beginning of the cuts, basically. There's a concern regarding the resources that remain to offer advice to communities and local authorities on how to design out crime. This has been compounded by some major changes in our planning system. We've got an emphasis on deregulation, which is aimed to stimulate the growth of development and give power to communities. And this has caused some concern. We have an act called the Localism Act that's just gone through Parliament. And basically, one of the key parts of this is that thousands of pages of planning guidance, which we have in the UK, which is based upon valuable evidence and valuable research, are being scrapped. All of them are going to be replaced by a 50-page national planning policy framework. So years and years of developing guidance in the UK is going. They're also introducing something called neighbourhood plans, where communities are required to come together through forums or councils and produce a neighbourhood plan saying where they want houses, shops and businesses to be built, and what they want them to look like. So they are making a decision about development, which could be brilliant because people tend to know what they want, but it could also not be brilliant. And we are concerned about the extent to which local communities possess the knowledge with reduced guidance and reduced police resources to know what is crime reductive design. So to conclude, we have a strong view that it's essential, but with reduced staff and increased responsibilities, communities have to have the evidence to make these choices. The decisions that they make could influence the quality of life and the quality of those neighbourhoods for years. So we have produced, with the Home Office funding and the Association of Chief Police Officers funding, a series of briefing notes, and as you can see here, they're very short. They've got loads of photos in, so I can't show you them all here. And we want people to use these on the ground, practitioners and communities, to make decisions, evidence-based decisions, on what they think that the development should look like. And I've got a selection of these at the front if you want to take any of them. So thank you very much for listening, and sorry that I went over by a couple of minutes.